Good morning. Please be seated. And welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's nice to see you both this morning. We have six cases on our calendar. Three are scheduled for oral argument. And the first case that we will be hearing this morning is case A211416, State of Minnesota versus Tamar Brian Long. And counsel, I know you're both familiar with the time limitations on your arguments. You have two microphone options this morning. You should feel free to use the microphones nearest your tables. The time will be counted down at the center console. You're welcome to use that if that's more comfortable for you. So with that, it looks like you are both ready to go. We can get started with counsel for appellant. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Jessica Merz-Gaddis. I represent the appellant, Tamar Long. Mr. Long was a passenger in a car that was lawfully parked on a city street. Within minutes of parking, the police seized the car's occupants, quote, to see why they were there. The police ran identity and warrant checks on the occupants, and they learned that Mr. Long had a warrant for his arrest. The police searched Mr. Long incident to arrest and found ammunition, which he was ineligible to possess. There are two issues before this court this morning. First, whether the police had a reasonable, articulable suspicion of criminal activity to justify seizing Mr. Long. And if not, the second issue being whether the attenuation doctrine allows the state to avoid the application of the exclusionary rule to the unlawful police conduct. As a threshold matter, the parties do agree that Mr. Long was seized. The dispute, again, is whether the seizure was lawful. To resolve that dispute, we need to be very, very clear about the deputy's basis for the seizure. At the omnibus hearing, the deputy testified six times he was investigating a, quote, suspicious activity call, unquote. So in turn, we need to be very clear about what that call actually said. A resident called 911 to report a car, again, lawfully parked on a city street in front of her house. The car had been there for approximately 5 minutes with the engine running and the lights off. The caller's mother's driver's license had recently been stolen, and so the caller was, quote, nervous and worried that it might be related that there was this car parked in front of her house.
And it was roughly 2:18 a.m.
Correct. Importantly, what the caller did not say was when, from where, or under what circumstances the mother's driver's license had been stolen, or anything else that objectively linked that car parked in front of her house to the stolen driver's license. To the contrary, the caller was abundantly clear she was purely speculating that these two facts might be related.
Ms. Gaddis, I just want to sort of explore the parameters of your seizure argument. Mm-hmm. Is it your argument that the seizure was improper at its outset, that the continued seizure was not justified by the circumstances present at the outset? And I know you're making an additional argument about the seizure of the identity of your client, but was the officer not justified in the very beginning based on those facts in detaining the occupants of the car?
To answer that latter question, Your Honor, I'd say absolutely not. The detention that happened right from the start was absolutely unlawful because it was not supported by a reasonable, articulable suspicion of criminal activity. To go back to your first question in terms of the moment of the seizure, we do agree with the district court, that Mr. Long, the passenger in the vehicle, was seized at the same time that the driver of the vehicle was seized. There is an argument that the seizure didn't happen at that same time, that the seizure of Mr. Long didn't happen until several minutes later when Mr. Long was asked for his identity and told to hold tight. But really, for this court's purposes, whichever moment in time you pick for the moment of Mr. Long's seizure really doesn't matter for purposes of this court's analysis on the lawfulness of the seizure. And that's because really the deputy's basis for seizing was exactly the same at both moments in time. And the facts known to the officer relative to what would be a basis to seize were exactly the same at both moments in time. So as I understand the state's brief, they agree with our position that the seizure happened of Mr. Long at the same time that the driver was seized.
Could you say a little more about why it would be important to know where the driver's license was taken, when, and that type of information?
Your Honor, the state seems to be making the suggestion, and the district court certainly found, that somehow the call that was placed to 911 about this lawfully parked car on the city street, that there was something suspicious about it being there related to that the driver's license had just been stolen. So our point is that there is absolutely nothing to support any connection between those two things. The fact that the caller called to indicate that the mother's driver's license had recently been stolen, the fact that that's all we know and no further details, nothing that in any way, shape, or form links this car to the theft of the driver's license, renders then unreasonable any kind of concern that that this car had anything to do with that theft and that the seizure of the people in this car could be justified on that basis.
So there's no temporal relationship, even though the word recently stolen is used?
That's correct, because the deputy was questioned at this on the at the omnibus hearing and made absolutely clear he did not know when it was, what recently means. I'm sorry, Your Honors, I just see that the timer didn't seem to start counting down, and I'm not sure if I'm at the right time now. It just switched to 8 minutes, but it's still holding tight at 8 minutes.
Yeah, you're not at the right time right now. You are at the right time at 9 minutes.
Okay.
So she has nine more minutes? Okay.
And it is counting down now.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just noticed that. I'm sorry. So just to wrap up on that point, Your Honors, that the point I'd like to make here is there is, to the extent that the deputy was relying on this, quote, suspicious activity call to justify the seizure in this case, there was absolutely no factual connection between the stolen driver's license and the car parked there that would have justified the seizure. Nor did that call provide any other information, any other reason about any other kind of possible criminal activity involved with that car that would have justified.
What if we just take out the driver's license altogether and look at the scenario as it existed? Is your argument that the officers should not have made contact with the individuals in the two vehicles based on a call at, 2 a.m, two occupied vehicles are parked in a quiet residential neighborhood?
Your Honor, there's a difference between the officers simply approaching the car and making some inquiries and the seizure that happened in this case. And that's the legal analytical point that we have to be clear about. I am not suggesting that the officers would not have had the authority to simply do what we sometimes casually refer to as a walk and talk, to approach the car and just casually start asking some questions. The difference for this court's purposes is what happened here was an actual seizure. And at that moment of seizure, when those people were detained, their identities were demanded, and their warrant status was checked, to do that, the officers needed to have a reasonable, articulable suspicion of criminal activity. And that's what's lacking in this case.
So at what point did it become a seizure? What point did it evolve?
So
from a walk and talk to a full-blown seizure.
So according to the deputy's testimony at the omnibus hearing, what he did was he first approached the vehicle, and he asked the occupants if they were okay, and they all affirmed that they were. He next asked, he also testified that he introduced himself to them. He asked if they were okay. They all affirmed that they were. He then asked what they were doing, and the driver explained that they were pulled over because they were searching for a hotel. As I understand it, the deputy kind of asked a little bit more about that. Why are you looking for a hotel? Why aren't you just going home? And the driver explained that she lived with her grandparents, and with COVID being what it was at that time, she was not allowed to bring these two guests of hers that were in her car with her to her home. It was at that point, then, that the officer demanded the driver's license and identification and took that back to the squad and ran a warrant check on her. That's the moment of seizure. Now, let's remember,
given the situation at that time, I think you you argued that the answers that were given to the officer weren't really suspicious about the hotel situation.
Correct.
And help me understand that, because given that it was, you know, a little after 2 a.m. in the morning, they were in a residential neighborhood that wasn't immediately off an exit, why wasn't that response suspicious?
Well, first of all, let's remember that the deputy himself did not testify that he thought there was anything suspicious about it. The state makes the claim in its brief that this was a, quote, far-fetched explanation for why they were there. The deputy never said that. The deputy never testified that he disbelieved it. The deputy never testified that he thought her answer was in any way evasive or that there was anything strange about it. All that the deputy said, remember, this is a state trooper we're talking about, so the state trooper is clearly very familiar with everything in the area, and he testified that he knew that there were hotels elsewhere at other exits farther down the road. But there's nothing in the record to support the idea that the people in this car knew that, that they were familiar with the area the way that the trooper was, or that there's anything strange about people pulling over, stopping, and looking at their phones. And when we're talking about searching for a hotel, we could just as easily be talking about it in terms of, I'm looking on my phone for hotels. And the deputy did testify that the driver had her phone open on her lap at the time that he approached the car. Let's remember, too, that what we're talking about here is a residential city street, couple blocks off Highway 169, and yes, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, but people come home from dates at that time. Friends drop friends off after bar close at that time. There's nothing unusual about a car being pulling up and stopping on a city street, publicly, public street, legally parked at that time. Indeed, there's no information from the caller, even, that there was anything strange about a car being parked in front of her house, about traffic being on her street at that time. And this is one point that I wanted to raise in my argument today in terms of something that the state raises in its brief, the suggestion that the deputy somehow knew that there was something unusual about a car being parked there. I take issue with that representation. The deputy actually testified that he did not know the area, he did not know the recent activity in the area, and he did not have any information that that area was either a high drug crime area or a high crime area in general. So there's nothing either from the deputy's own knowledge, from the call that came, from anything in this record to support the idea that this car parked in this place at this time is unusual.
Ms. Gattis, I just want to point out quickly, I know you're starting to get short on time. The deputy did testify at the hearing, this is on page 14 of the transcript, when asked about this explanation of hotels. Did her response draw any suspicion from you? And he said, it did for the fact that she was pulled into a not well-lit area. It was a neighborhood fully residential. And if you were an individual looking for a hotel off of Highway 169, if you went a little further south, for example, 394, you probably would have pulled into a hotel parking lot. So I think he did say that that answer from her did cause him to have some suspicion.
That exact passage that you just read, Your Honor, is what I was referring to a few moments ago when I was talking about the trooper here having his own knowledge of the area. I think that's the passage in the record that makes clear that the trooper certainly knew the area and the trooper knew that there were hotels farther down. But there's nothing in that answer that you just read or anything else in the record that supports the idea that the driver or the occupants of the car had that same knowledge. Or that in any way the deputy thought that it was strange that those people wouldn't have the same level of knowledge of the area that he had.
Can we talk briefly about the attenuation question and attenuation doctrine, focusing on the third factor?
Yes.
Can you explain to me why why we should conclude that the deputy's warrant check was the sort of purpose and flagrancy of official misconduct that the exclusionary rule is designed to deter?
Certainly. Thank you for the question, Your Honor. I'll do my best in my remaining minute here. Really what this factor comes down to is the distinctions that I will make for you between facts of this case and the facts of Streiff. Recall that in Streif, what happened there was an officer observed the defendant in that case come out of what the court classified as a seizure that happened in connection with a bona fide investigation of a suspected drug house, or in other words, a house whose occupants were legitimately suspected of dealing drugs. So there in Streif, at least you had a defendant who was leaving a house that was legitimately suspected of being involved in criminal activity. We don't have the same kind of facts in this case. Here we have no investigation into anything related to anything in this case. The deputy had not been investigating the car, the house, the stolen driver's license, nothing. He's coming into this completely fresh. Also, because there was no investigation going on, this deputy didn't corroborate anything relative to that criminal activity. That's another distinction from Streif, where there was corroboration of the short-term traffic coming and going from that house. I see my time is up. I just have one quick point if I could.
You may finish your thought.
Say now, thank you. The third significant distinction from Streif is that in Streif there was one officer that detained and promptly identified and did a warrant check. Here, let's recall that we have two deputies that initiate and escalate an investigation, with each step of their investigation that fails to uncover any reasonable suspicion of criminal activity at all, they continue to escalate the investigation. And while they do so, six additional squads arrive on scene as part of this investigation. So this case is an escalation and a show of force, unlike what was at issue in Streif. And for those reasons, the purpose and the flagrancy of the official misconduct in this case weighs in favor of suppression. Thank you.
Thanks for your argument. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And next, we will hear from counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, John Schmidt, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney on behalf of the state of Minnesota. This court should affirm because the district court properly denied the motion to suppress on two different grounds. First, Long was properly seized and lawfully arrested. And second, the attenuation doctrine applies to this situation and the evidence was appropriately admitted. Under either theory, this court should affirm. First, the deputy had reasonable articular suspicion of criminal activity sufficient to do investigatory investigation, and the standard of such is not high. There are the totality of the circumstances here supports the reasonable articular suspicion to do the investigatory seizure. First, it's the report, the deputy's training and experience, and the suspicion that continued to grow at each step of the interaction demonstrates that this investigation was lawful. First, the caller reported in suspicious activity. The caller was, quote, nervous and worried about cars parked in a quiet residential neighborhood in front of her house. Now, the inference behind that is, why was the person making the call in the first place? This wasn't a usual situation for this caller to have cars out in front of her house, lights off, still running, at 2 a.m. in the morning, particularly because her mom's purse was recently stolen. So
is
she was
the purse or the ID?
I think there was a, I believe it was the entire purse was stolen.
But where in the transcript can we find?
Well, I know the district court did say the purse was stolen. The district court was wrong about that day. It was recently. But at the addendum on page 2, it talks about a purse being stolen. But for sure, the identification was stolen. And so they had the address on the identification, whether it was the whole purse or the identification. I mean, the key point is that they had the identification and they had the address, and that was the connection between the two.
Is there testimony in the record that the identification had the address of the caller on it?
Well, the testimony comes from the caller saying, my mom's identification was recently stolen.
Right.
There are two cars out in front of my mom's house, and I'm nervous and worried about that.
Is there testimony that the mom lived at the house? It's the mom's identification, and you're inferring, I think, that the mother lived at the home, but I'm wondering if there's testimony that the mother lived at the home.
The only testimony is just from the report of the caller that the deputy received, that said, my mom's purse was recently, or identification was recently stolen, and there are two cars outside of her house. There isn't additional testimony from the caller or from the reporting party to say, my mom's at that house right now, I'm really concerned about her safety. There's none of that exists. It's just what the deputy had at the time. And what the deputy had at the time is two cars in front of my mom's house. Identification was stolen. And I'm worried and nervous about that. And so in terms of what the deputy knew at the time, it's I am going to the reporting parties to where these cars are sitting in front of a house because identification was recently stolen and I'm concerned about my mom. That was the full extent of that.
Thank you.
One thing, and frankly, this isn't great for me, but counsel did a great job reciting the facts of this case, and I just want to add to what she said. I believe that there is testimony that as soon as they pulled up behind the cars, they turned on their squad lights, which adds to counsel's argument, but I just wanted to make sure that was clear in the record as well.
So by pointing out that fact to us, are you suggesting that the seizure occurred even before Ms. Gaddis alleges that it did?
I don't dispute that at the latest the seizure occurred when, as the district court found, when they asked for the driver's license of the driver. Arguably, it may have occurred even before that because the squad lights were on. And, you know, a person wouldn't feel free to leave at that time with officer squad lights on behind them. So potentially, yes, but I'm not disputing the fact that when the driver's when the deputy asked for the driver's license, the seizure occurred. So there, the first part is the reporting parties call of suspicious activity. The next is the deputy's experience that contributed to that suspicion. The deputy driving up, although not familiar with this neighborhood, driving up into a quiet residential area. There aren't other cars parked on the street. This isn't, for example, Snelling Avenue, where you might have cars regularly parked on a street, or even if you're new to Snelling Avenue, see apartment buildings and cars parked on the street at 2 in the morning. This is a quiet residential area, and this is several blocks off from a highway. Also new, the purse was, or the identification was recently taken, and the officer testified very clearly that he was concerned about the house was about to be burglarized, or was being cased for a burglary. Now, the officer also testified in his experience, he knew it's regular practice of burglars to operate at night in darkened areas and have escape of vehicles nearby. That's at page 42 to 43 of the transcript. The suspicion then only grew after that stop. The cars again parked in a residential neighborhood. The driver claimed to be coming from Brooklyn Park and was looking for a hotel. The driver also noted that they couldn't stay with her grandparents. That adds some familiarity of at least the area of the highway. But the driver, rather than looking at the signs on the highway, which again is an inference that can be taken from the facts, chose to drive several blocks off the highway and park in a purely residential neighborhood. Now, if they are truly looking for a hotel, they could stop shortly after the highway and realize there's nothing, no signs pointing to a gas station or to a hotel right off the highway, stop closer to the highway and check their phones and move on. Alternatively, they can get back on the highway and keep driving down for another stop. The officer did testify this was a weird place to look for a hotel. That adds to the suspicion. That's on page 37 of the transcript. As they investigate, the second vehicle, the driver, had a warrant out for her arrest. And so that adds to the suspicion of the entire totality of the circumstances.
Help me understand that. How does that add to the suspicion about the other car?
Well, working with a partner, there's two cars, both lights off, parked right next to each other. One is going to the one car, our deputy is going to this car. In running the check on that driver, finding out that they have a warrant, it adds to the totality of the circumstances of the suspicion of two cars sitting out there in a residential neighborhood at night with somebody who just reported that I'm worried and concerned about this, given it's in front of my mom's house, and her identification was recently stolen. And it adds to the suspicion that the deputy noted that this house is being potentially cased to be burglarized or about to be burglarized. And so to add to that suspicion that somebody already has a warrant out for their arrest in the other vehicle, it was a sign and release, and so the person was able to drive away, and they effectuated that. And that was before the deputy came back to our vehicle to ask for identification of the people in the back seat.
Is there any indication what the warrant was for?
I don't recall.
Okay, thank you.
But it was a sign and release. I think in the totality of these circumstances, this is not whim or idle curiosity. This was at each step of the investigation was a logical next step, adding to the suspicion and coming to a reasonable articular suspicion to ask for the identification of the other passengers in the vehicle. The second factor that this court could also affirm on is the attenuation doctrine. There are three factors for that, and the first two are not really disputed here: temporal proximity or the intervening circumstances. Neither of those appear to be disputed. It is just the third factor, which is the purpose and flagrancy of the conduct. The district court held that the deputy's actions logically flowed from one step to the next. And the deputies, like in Strife, the decision here to identify the passengers and run a warrant check was negligibly burdensome. And I don't think this case is all that distinguishable from Strife. Yes, in Strife, there was additional investigation. The officer received an anonymous tip in that situation about a drug house. The officer did do some investigation and watched people coming and going from the house over a course of a week, and then stopped somebody who was legally leaving a house. That was the entire scope of the analysis of what that officer knew at that time. Anonymous tip, people coming and going, stopping somebody legally leaving that house. And in that case, it was found that the evidence should not be suppressed on the attenuation doctrine because the intervening circumstance of having a warrant was sufficient to arrest the person. And it's similar here. The deputy had reasonable suspicion at each logical step. The cars outside the house, more suspicion grew, the officer's training and experience, the identification of Long checked, outstanding warrant, and he was arrested.
Mr. Schmidt, by the time that Mr. Long's identity was requested, we were well into the stop here. It seems to me that the deputies were sort of coming up short. I mean, there was a DWI investigation and, the driver dispelled any suspicion that she was under the influence. You had a sign and release warrant, but that's about it. I'm wondering, besides the initial justification provided for the stop, I'm wondering, what was the reasonable basis for requesting Mr. Long's identification and prolonging the stop at that point?
Based on the totality of the entire circumstances. And so this is something that it starts with that call. It starts with the fact that they're in a place that makes no sense for them to be at 2 a.m. and that was such that made somebody call to report them sitting out there with their vehicles running. From the time of the report until the time of their arrival, the cars were still there with their lights off and the vehicles running. So if it was something that was less suspicious, they may have moved on already. And then during the investigation with the warrant out for the person in the other vehicle, towards the end of his testimony, the deputy did say that he could see through the passenger window some drug paraphernalia. That wasn't part of the earlier part, and I think it's unclear when in the timeline that came about. So, within those totality of the circumstances, I think it is reasonable that this was not based on whim or idle curiosity in order to justify that. Now, if we're in the attenuation doctrine, we're assuming that the purpose and the conduct was wrong. Otherwise, we're not there. And so we're assuming that, okay, maybe he didn't have the reasonable articular suspicion for a complete seizure and to do the investigatory steps that he did. And again, we're saying he had all that, but if we're into this world, we're assuming he was wrong. And then it's the idea of, is the purpose of that investigation, was it so flagrant, was it so bad that this evidence should be suppressed?
What about the argument that the encounter, I mean, it was gradually, despite the fact that the circumstances were not really heightening any of the suspicions there, the circumstances discovered during the course of the stop. What about Ms. Gattas's argument that in spite of that, the escalation of the stop was sort of increasing dramatically at some point? You know, you had seven cars, police cars on the scene. What's your response to that?
Well, first, you'd have to accept counsel's argument that their answers were not suspicious, that the fact that they're in this quiet residential neighborhood was not suspicious, that the call did not arise to a suspicion in order to do the seizure. The officer testified that it was suspicious, that he was following up on this suspicious call. The answers didn't make sense. It was weird to be looking at a hotel in this area. And the district court made those findings, found the deputy credible, and none of those findings are clearly erroneous. And so starting with that premise, that it is unusual in the first place, that their answers aren't adding up, it is that the suspicion is growing. Now, it's true other cars did arrive. This was a state patrol deputy who responded to the call because the local police were not available at the time. So he and his partner responded to the call, got to the scene. By the time they got to the scene, they started their investigation, then other squads started responding. Now, maybe they should have called him off. I don't know how that works, and that's not in our record.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Mr. Schmidt, I was curious about that because it seemed like the officer was saying that these Golden Valley officers arrived really on their own. I mean, after they got cleared from whatever they were doing and then responded. Does our case law distinguish in this show of force analysis in any way between whether or not they were called by officers on the scene or whether they're just coming independently? I'm curious.
I don't know that the case law does. I honestly don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
So I'm sorry I can't give you a good answer to that.
There may not be one. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Gattas, you have 5 minutes on the clock.
Thank you. There's 3 points I hope to make on rebuttal. The first, I'd like to respond to the suggestion that the deputy himself thought he was responding to a possible burglary. I disagree with that wholeheartedly. The deputy did not think he was investigating a possible burglary, nor would there be any objective basis in the record for such a belief had it existed. The state makes that argument relying on an answer that the deputy gave to the prosecutor's compound leading question that suggested that possibly a burglary could be suspected here. I've detailed this answer for you at pages 1 and 2 of my reply brief. I'm not going to read that answer to you now, but that's there. When you place that answer in context of the full record, what you see, you've got to remember that 6 times when this deputy is asked for his own narrative explanation about what were you concerned about, what was suspicious, why were you investigating, that deputy explains that the suspicious activity he was investigating was the call that was made and the information in the call. And the information in that call, as I've talked about significantly in my principal argument, did not contain any kind of concern whatsoever about a possible burglary. To your point, Judge Cochran, when you were asking my opposing counsel about whether there's any information in the record about the driver's license and the address on this driver's license, there is none. We don't know that either the mother lived at this house or that the address on her driver's license was the address of this house. Even if we did, and even if it's reasonable to infer that that was the reason that the caller was concerned was because the license address did match her address, I'm still hard-pressed to understand how just the knowledge of an address could possibly give rise to a reasonable, articulable suspicion that the car was there to burglarize, particularly when the caller did not say that and the deputy did not think that either. The second point I'd like to make is that even if, and again, I dispute wholeheartedly that there was anything unreasonable or confusing about the defendant or the driver's explanation about why they were parked there, but even if this court did think there was reason to doubt the driver's explanation or it didn't make sense, that is still not a particularized and objective basis for the officer to detain Mr. Long. That's the driver's answer. That's not Mr. Long's answer. And I've detailed case law for you in the brief about any kind of suspicion of criminal activity related to one person is not necessarily imputed to a person who's with them. State v. Deedy is the primary case that comes to mind. That's the driver's answer. If you don't believe it, it's not Mr. Long's. It's not a particularized and objective basis to seize him. Finally, I'd like to pop back, if I could, to finish answering the question you asked Judge Cochran in the earlier argument about the attenuation doctrine and the purpose and flagrancy. Again, these cases are in the brief, but I'd like to highlight them for you, point you back to your two cases of Bergerson and Johnson. In Bergerson, you talked about how seizing a person to identify him and discover his intentions is, quote, precisely the type of conduct the exclusionary rule is intended to prevent. And in Johnson, you rejected the idea that it was lawful to run a warrant check on a person above and beyond just simply verifying their identity, where the officer had no articulable suspicion of criminal activity that justified that warrant check in particular. You said in Johnson, quote, requesting appellant's identification with no suspicion of criminal activity and then taking that identification to run a warrant check was a fishing expedition. I submit to you that that's exactly what we've got going on here. The deputy's conduct in this case was precisely the kind of conduct that the exclusionary rule was meant to deter. It was purposeful, it was flagrant, and it favors suppression in this case. Because the state also agrees with us that the first factor here, the temporal proximity between the unlawful conduct and the seizure of the evidence, also favors suppression. Two of the three factors weigh in our favor. They favor suppression. The district court was wrong to rule otherwise, and I respectfully request that this court reverse the district court's ruling on the suppression issue and Mr. Long's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your very helpful arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to us, and we will be issuing our decision within the statutory time frame.